now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business. Joining us today are The Times' very own Alison Rudd, James Gearbrandt and Paul Joyce. Coming up, we'll look back on Super Silva by the Seaside and Steve Bruce's stunning Spurs. But first, to the big game of the weekend at Anfield and Liverpool being simply too good for Unai Emery's Arsenal. Arsenal's new signing from Chelsea was at fault for two of Liverpool's goals, pulling back Mo Salah in the box to allow the Egyptian to convert from the spot before diving in needlessly to allow Salah to run away and seal the second of the game. So Paul, is David Luiz a liability in big games for Arsenal?
Well, I think certainly he was, you know, he didn't show the leadership at the weekend that was, that Emery probably thought he was recruiting when he signed him from Chelsea. I think that the tug on Salah was needless, and because he was booked in the penalty incident, it meant he couldn't get near him and couldn't contemplate bringing him down for the second goal, or else he would have been sent off and out of the North London derby this weekend. I think, you know, this image, isn't there, of David Luiz of being, you know, a bit of a comical figure and defensive from a defensive point of view, and it's probably a little harsh because we remember all the bad things, but certainly I think Arsenal haven't done enough to look at the defensive issues that were evident last season. I think they conceded 51 goals in the Premier League. I think there was signs in pre-season, even before they signed David Luiz, that they'd not addressed those shortcomings properly. And you know, looking at them at the weekend, I still think that's going to be their Achilles heel. That Nicolas Pepe looked promising in attack, although his finishing let him down on a couple of occasions. But I just think relying on your front line to score 3-4 goals at the big six, especially away from home at the big six, is just not going to be sustainable for Arsenal. And yeah, I just think as much as they've sort of, the perception has been that they had quite a good summer transfer window. For me, I don't think they did enough to alleviate the design faults that have been there for so many years now.
I think we can all agree that Arsenal's defence was the concern even before Luiz was signed, and Luiz was supposed to bring that bit of leadership experience and two games in, and we've sort of had a pretty stark reminder of the flaws in David Luiz's ability. Alison, what did you make of
first of all, David Luiz is an emotional character, and if the team is not set up properly, he's one of those defenders who's liable to think it's on his shoulders to make things right. So he was very exposed. So it's not entirely his fault. I thought you were going to ask me why were they set up as a diamond midfield there. But I mean, that is part of the answer as to why David Luiz was so exposed, because it was last ditch defending, and he doesn't always make the wise decisions. He's a better player when his team are in control and they're set up properly, and he feels he's setting in motion something that's been well devised and thought through. I think Emery needs to have a really long think about. I mean, Paul, you pointed out in your piece, I think, that they just, under Emery, they've not won any of the games against the top six.
Two draws, I think. That's
away from home. That shows maybe he's overthinking it. He certainly overthought it at Anfield, I thought, because you could see what he was thinking. He was thinking, I've got, okay, my defence might not be perfect yet, but I've got pace in my team. If I clog the midfield, I can suck Liverpool's fullbacks forward and I can catch Liverpool on the break, because that's the only advantage I have. But in fact, they did look quite good on the break from time to time, but he just gave too much leeway to Liverpool's fullbacks to dictate the game a bit.
Yeah, Paul, even Jurgen Klopp admitted he was surprised to see Emery set up with a diamond formation midfield. What did you make of that? I think there was 18 crosses from open play from Alexander-Arnold and Robertson, the two fullbacks.
Yeah, I think Alexander-Arnold certainly had the most touches of any Premier League player playing on Saturday. I thought it was curious, really, given the amount of assists that came from Liverpool's fullbacks last season, to give them almost free rein down the flanks was a bit baffling, and you just thought that while the crossing wasn't great to begin with, you just thought there would always be eventually, you know, something would give, and there would be a goal that came from one of the sides. I mean, I think one of the interesting stats that came up for me from the weekend was, even though Emery tried to get control of the centre of the pitch with the diamond, Liverpool made 24 tackles compared to Arsenal's 15, I think it was, and it just shows the relentlessness of this Liverpool team under Klopp, and how their appetite to go and go and go and constantly, you know, go again and win back the ball.
There was one moment, I think it was in the first half, when Liverpool were really pressing, like, relentlessly, yeah, as you said, and Ceballos tried to play that switch across from his own corner flag.
Yeah, and it went straight to Manny, and he had the shot at goal. Yeah, I just think we can sort of criticise sort of Arsenal, and I think there was a certain, you know, Emery didn't get it quite right, but also this Liverpool team is developing into a very, very good team, and, you know, Alisson saw the win at Southampton, I think, the previous week, and on the back of the Super Cup, that was a real sort of, the Super Cup in Istanbul final, that was a real sort of marker down, I thought, very earlier in the season, and then the way that they just kept going against Arsenal, and Klopp use the expression sort of physically broke them. I think we have to sort of give Liverpool a bit of credit as well, and not just say that Arsenal were, you know, were same old Arsenal. I think he needs to refine his approach at certain moments, and I think it's a season when Emery has to step up as a coach, because he's had that first season bedding in now, and you want to see an improvement, but I think Liverpool will do what they did to Arsenal, to a lot of teams this season.
I think the only thing is, the kind of build up to the game, everyone was quite excited to see Arsenal's front three, and Liverpool's defence hasn't looked particularly sort of impressive so far this season, compared to last season anyway. And I suppose that was the only disappointing thing. We didn't really get to see that at all until Liverpool were 3-0 up, really. And this is the two teams with 100% record going into, it's early in the season, but going into that game. And do you think we've kind of seen the gulf between these two clubs pretty much emphasised?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit about level. And obviously the phrase that Klopp used at the weekend, which has got a lot of attention, is intensity is our identity. And I just think it'll be interesting to see whether they can maintain that over the course of the season. Playing with that sort of relentlessness that we saw at the weekend. If they can do, they can go close in a lot of competitions again. But yeah, I think Arsenal have got work to do. I actually liked what I saw in Pepe. I liked the way that he took on Van Dijk, especially in the first half. I thought Van Dijk sort of stepped up again after the break. Just the best chances for Arsenal really came from Liverpool mistakes, the Adrian clearing straight to Aubameyang, and the Henderson miscontrol that allowed Nicolas Pepe to go through. So I think Arsenal's still got a lot of work to do, and I just think unless they get a bit more solidity, especially away from home against these top sides, it's going to be difficult for them to you know, get back into the top four.
James, as someone who takes a keen interest in the tactical side of the game, what did you make of the way that Emery set up Arsenal on Saturday?
I did think it was a bit of a mistake, and not even just in the kind of tactical sense of the game, but I just thought, you know, this was an opportunity to actually, as we've said, you know, in recent episodes, Liverpool's defence had not been looking at its most secure in the sort of opening weeks of the season, and they seemed to be sort of playing slightly higher line, giving up slightly better chances than we expected to see. And I just thought this was a real chance for Emery to be proactive and go on the front foot and play his best players and target a perceived weakness in Liverpool, rather than setting up reactively and trying to preempt what Liverpool were going to do. For me, I just feel like you didn't need to go into that game with Matteo Guendouzi and Joe Willock, you know, and leave Lacazette on the bench. Mm. For me, that's, you know, you can overcomplicate the tactical side of things, but I do think there's a lot to be said for playing your best players. And, you know, if we know that Arsenal's squad is lopsided and that there's a real concentration of talent towards the top end of the pitch, fine. But, you know, play to those strengths. Don't sort of neuter them. I thought it was a mistake.
Well, it's the London derby next weekend, and Spurs were shocked by Newcastle, who got their first win under Steve Bruce. Club record signing Joe Ellington scored his first goal in English football. I think Steve Bruce really needed that, didn't he, Alison?
Yeah, that it was arguably the most interesting game of the weekend because of the amount of vitriol towards Steve Bruce. There was the whole Michael Chopra debacle.
Yeah.
It's rare, really, isn't it, for a manager to directly answer a Twitter complaint. And I know Chopra's a Newcastle fan. He didn't really do much at Newcastle, I don't think, as a player. But, I mean, when former players or famous fans are chipping in on social media and phone-ins and so on, you've only been there a couple of weeks, virtually.
Yeah.
It's incredibly tough. And the sort of backdrop that could have completely sunk him, because the fans weren't on side yet. And as I've said on a previous podcast, you know, he's not Rafa Benitez. That's his greatest sin, really. He's not him. But Bruce argued, in the face of all the criticism, you must be unhinged if you think, I don't know, and my team don't know how to set up my coaching staff don't know how to set up a team to be able to defend properly. And he did inherit a team that under Benitez had learned to be very resolute and get their system straight. Just concentrate for 90 minutes and be dour if necessary. So I think he used that sort of siege mentality, plucked from the team the good points from last season, and he showed that if you do maintain your shape, you can get a good result. It wasn't thrilling football from them, but they played to their strengths. And yeah, as you say, it was absolutely necessary after an appalling week of criticism that he did something.
James, he certainly did look very, very well organised. They did park the bus, but it was a good game for Joe Ellington, a good start. He led the line very well. It was a good weekend, in fact, for sort of imposing number nines. There was Wesley for Villa, mm-hmm. Sebastian Allaire scored a couple of goals, and Tammy Abraham as well. But he looked pretty impressive, didn't he?
I mean, yeah, it's obviously very early days for Joe Ellington, but I think he's looked good so far. But I think for Tottenham, this was a concerning game. I feel Tottenham have not played well in the league for a long time. And I'm talking about, you know, a sustained run of games, as opposed to, they've had the odd good performance. But Tottenham have not looked and had a really strong run of form in the league for a while. And I just feel that they're really, sort of going back to kind of last Christmas, when they were near the top of the league, and everyone was sort of saying, you know, a Tottenham part of a three-way title race, and obviously they weren't, and all the kind of chickens that, you know, they're sort of, they hadn't been playing as well as their results kind of suggested, and that all came home to roost. And I feel they're really struggling at the moment too. They're struggling to break down teams. They look quite kind of ponderous and just lacking a little bit of invention and kind of creativity and possession. And obviously the whole kind of Eriksen saga feeds into that.
How much do you think that is an issue? Pochettino spoke about that after the game and said it's the most unsettled that his Spurs squad has been since in his time at the club. How much do you think that is having an effect?
Eriksen in particular?
Well, there's several players, aren't there? But Eriksen is the sort of... leaving him out of the team is a nonsense, really.
I feel... Well, we know that Pochettino, he has this... I love Pochettino. Fantastic coach. Absolutely brilliant coach. But we know he has this kind of real kind of strongman, sort of authoritarian streak. Like, he is not afraid to drop players that he doesn't feel are kind of 100% committed to the cause. And... I mean, he's done that for, you know, a long time with sort of, he's been surprisingly able to pursue that policy whilst keeping the team very buoyant. But I just feel, you know, obviously Vertonghen isn't playing at the moment and Eriksen appears to be in something of a similar position. And I just feel that's really hurting the team at the moment, not having those two top players.
I think if you look maybe 12, 18 months down the line, Tottenham's team could look very different. There's some, you know, some key players that are unsettled and possibly looking for the exit. And what do you think? Do you think, Alison, do you think that Spurs could look quite a lot different in maybe 18 months' time?
Possibly. They had 80% possession and two shots on target. They're sort of eating themselves at Tottenham at the moment. They just seem to be becoming a sort of over-rarefied version of what Pochettino wants them to be. I really don't buy this narrative that because he has certain players who are unsettled and might leave or might not, that infects the team. I don't believe that. If that is true, then Pochettino, who I agree with James, he has a lot of attributes as a coach, and one of them is supposed to be man management. This is where he steps up, isn't it? When if there are players who have expressed an interest in leaving but haven't left yet, you manage their ability to, if they want to just show off a bit for the club you want to go to. I mean, I just think given that they reached the Champions League final, which was not foreseen by anybody, that I mean, you know, okay, parallel, Liverpool lose the title by 1 point and they don't go, oh, we got close and that was awful, we're going to be awful this season. No, they use that as a motivation to look even better and more likely to win the title this season. I would have I expected Spurs getting to the Champions League final to, you know, to really use that for all the people who have had downers on them and their transfer policy and so on. They've had some money spent. Really, you've spent money and now you're blaming the players you've already got who might be leaving for that stat of 80% possession, two shots on target. I just think Pochettino might be, I don't know, getting too fussy about his role, to be quite honest, too particular.
I agree with that. I think Alison's made a number of brilliant points there. He's beginning to sound a bit like Mourinho for me. You know, the sort of today, you know, my players didn't have enough desire earlier in the summer, the sort of veiled comments about his future. And going back to what Alison said then about the sort of building on the Champions League, I mean, it's a ridiculous situation that the manager, three games into the season, is saying he doesn't know whether Eriksen is going to still be here at the end of the month or not. I mean, that's for him and Daniel Levy to say to Eriksen, no, you're not going.
Yeah.
And for a decision to be made before the first game of the season, no, you're not going. You know, if you contrast the way, it's not all about just going back, harping back onto Liverpool, but if you were to contrast the way that Liverpool handled the Coutinho situation when he, in the summer of 2017, I think it was, when he first wanted to go, he was told at the start of August, end of July, there's no way that you're leaving. You can put in as many transfer requests. You're not going. And, you know, he kicked up for a bit and Spurs are fortunate that Eriksen hasn't done that in this situation. But I just think there's been a lack of sort of leadership from Pochettino, from Daniel Levy on this whole issue, and for it still to be sort of clouding, you know, Tottenham's start to the season is a nonsense, really. How can a club that has designs to be ambitious allow itself to be in this situation?
There was a table doing the rounds on social media this morning, tweeted by Matt Furness of Opta, which is the Premier League table since February the 2nd. So that's the last 17 games. And Tottenham are 12th in that span. Tottenham are 12th. They've taken 21 points from their last 17 Premier League games. That's 9 points behind Crystal Palace.
Wow.
In that period.
That's a good link.
Where are Manchester United in there, by the way?
10th. Not much better.
10th, okay. Well, that's who we're going to talk about next. Manchester United were... That's another surprise at Old Trafford. Crystal Palace's first win at Old Trafford since 1989. Patrick Van Aanholt netted in the 93rd minute, smashing home a loose ball after Wilfred Zaha's burst forward. And Daniel James thought he'd rescued a point for United when he curled home an equaliser in the 89th minute. Gary Cahill, 33, got man of the match. Potentially could have seen red, but he only made 2 appearances all season last season. What do we think, Alison? Is he a shrewd signing by Roy Hodgson?
No, very shrewd indeed. I mean, he's not the youngest defender you'll sign, but I mean, what I like most about defenders is the way they read the game, and sometimes you can have really quite slow blokes at the back, and you think, well, how come they look like a god? Because they're old and they're slow. It's because they read the game so well and they anticipate. And if you anticipate, you are faster than the nippiest forward because you've thought before he has thought where the ball's going to go and where the danger is. And what I've always liked about Cahill is that he's sort of safety first. He reads the game exceptionally well. When United did threaten, he was there to block, head away, clear, body on the line sort of approach to the game. And you can afford someone who's slightly older and maybe didn't have much game time for a whole season to come into your team if everyone else around you is young and they just look to him to, you know, just point the way, tell people where to move and so on. And, you know, one day he will, Gary Cahill, well, I think he already has actually, look back and think, oh, my word, why did I waste a whole season? Because it's such a short career as a player and he wasted a whole season doing nothing at all when he could have been at Palace or Fulham or somewhere doing something. So that, and I also think that might inspire him to have a consistently good season beyond this one game at Old Trafford, because he knows he wasted a year of his life.
He was almost a bit of a kind of scapegoat last season. There were times where it seemed harsh that he wasn't even involved at all. And he does seem 33, he's getting on a bit, but for a centre half, he's I think that's an excellent free transfer, James.
Yeah, it's a very kind of Roy Hodgson signing,
yeah.
I think. Obviously last season Maurizio Sarri just didn't feel he was kind of compatible with his vision of football, and so he was on the margins, but he's well suited to what Hodgson's trying to do at Crystal Palace, I think, and I think he'll obviously bring those intangibles as well, you know, the experience, kind of the nous and those kind of things.
I think he would have been a savvy free transfer signer for Arsenal.
You know, I think you're probably right, yeah.
And possibly somebody like Everton, who, you know, was struggling to get, well, and struggled to get Kurt Zouma from Chelsea permanently. I think in Everton's case, they were looking at an age range of players of sort of 27 and below. I think Fabian Delph might just is a bit older than that, but in general speaking they were looking at younger players. But I just think somebody like Cahill, with all his experience and his sort of nous, would have been certainly a good signing for Everton and certainly would have been, you know, a decent acquisition for Arsenal.
From Manchester United's perspective, there was more problems with penalty kicks. Marcus Rashford saw his penalty hit the post to make it 2 misses and 2 for United, as Rashford and Pogba continue to share penalty duties. Well, what do you make of the situation over penalty kicks at Old Trafford?
I think it's a little bit of, again, a little bit of lack of authority from the manager. Rashford was to me, was Manchester United's penalty taker, the penalty against Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League that got them through that game. I think it should have been, you know, Solskjaer should have designated him. He should have taken it at Wolves. And if he missed, he should have taken it. Again, you get a couple of chances and then maybe it goes to somebody else. I just don't think it sends out a good message, the sort of chopping and changing. To me, it says that the players are having too much influence on what Solskjaer's doing. And I think
Solskjaer's letting... I think, for me, the problem is... I mean, I think, first of all, the Rashford penalty on Saturday was not the issue. Rashford's a good penalty taker. He aimed for the corner. He hit the post. It happens. It's like the first one that he's missed for ages.
But do you think the situation added pressure to that kick for him?
I think for me, yeah. I don't know whether it did or it didn't. That's the kind of thing only he will know. But the optics of it are terrible, I think. I think it's a fundamental kind of misreading of the modern player, I think. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we know, is obsessed with trying to kind of bring back this sort of rose-tinted view of the past and sort of, you know, kind of encouraged to, you know, he wants to sort of encourage players to take a bit of responsibility on the pitch and sort of, you know, a bit of improvisation and initiative on the pitch as things were in his day. But I think modern players don't work like that. Modern players want to kind of be micromanaged and they want to know exactly what they're doing before they step out on the field. And I think to have this situation where you've turned something which was an absolute non-issue into something which is now going to hang over all the subsequent penalties that Manchester United take until the issue is resolved. For me, it's such a self-inflicted problem, but I think it's really bad management, actually.
It's very poor grasp of psychology, isn't it? Because if you make your players have to fight or publicly decide, I feel good about taking this penalty, so you have a conversation on the pitch or whatever form it takes, you've just piled so much pressure on yourself. I mean, it's ridiculous. That just doesn't work. They do say the way to get through penalties is to never change your mind, to have practiced so much that you know you're perfect, so that when you step up, your mind is empty of doubt because you know you've done it 100 times. How can having a conversation beforehand help that? It cannot.
It's costing them points.
Well, it is costing them points. I mean, it was a kind of freaky game, in that Palace were very defensive and took their chances, and United had more chances and more possession and didn't take them, and including didn't take a penalty. So yes, and who knows, maybe that seeps through the team, that they feel they haven't quite got the pizzazz in front of goal that they should have. Certainly there's a lot of young players there who they can do without politics. There's too much politics at Old Trafford.
Well, we've still got VAR to talk about, so there's plenty more politics to come.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
No such troubles for Manchester City. Pep Guardiola hailed David Silva as one of the best players he has ever seen after he contributed to all three of Manchester City's goals in a convincing win at Bournemouth. Silva, making his 400th appearance for City, helped the champions move up to second in the Premier League, 2 points behind leaders Liverpool. James, where do you think David Silva, this is his last season in the Premier League, where do you think we will rank him in the sort of pantheon of Premier League greats in midfield?
Well, I think a while ago we had to pick our best Premier League 11 of the 2010s. For me, David Silva and Sergio Aguero were the first kind of the most kind of indisputable names on there, just because of the kind of consistency of their excellence and their longevity. I mean, I think David Silva's been there since 2010, so nine seasons. And I think, yeah, I mean, and, you know, obviously in that time, the Manchester City team has kind of touched, you know, heights of attacking football that, you know, probably haven't been reached in the Premier League era before. I think it's interesting because if you look at the sort of, if you talk about the kind of the great midfielders of the previous decade, you sort of think of players with kind of immense force of personality, like, you know, your Keens and your Vieiras and so on. And Silva kind of, I think, is more emblematic of the current era because he sort of, he doesn't really appear to have that to me. He's quite a sort of quite a subtle and almost sort of anonymous figure, but he's just such an excellent footballer, and he has been, you know, he's been one of the most consistently excellent footballers in the Premier League this decade.
Alison, Manchester City, they have another Silva to probably fill his shoes from next season, but they are hard shoes to fill. It's going to be, he's not really a player that's easy to replace, is it?
No. And I think as the season progresses, there'll be a lot of sort of mournful faces around the Etihad as they contemplate him not being there. He's an exquisite footballer, and as James says, he's understated as well. He's not. When I think of great midfielders, I think of players who really get stuck in. I like a player who deserves the chance to play the killer pass because they won the ball with a really tough tackle and a clever tackle and so on. He's not that. He's very non-English in that sense, and he's brought sort of continental exoticism to the Premier League. He has been injured and City have missed him, but they've also absorbed his absence because they have so much depth of talent. And it's not like he's like a one-off. They've got players who can thread the ball through an eye of a needle, all, you know, in all positions. So they will absorb his loss, but I think it's, yeah, his longevity and the fact that he quietly knits it all together for them sometimes. He's often not the obvious star, but if you analyse it, oh, that happened because David Silva can see the perfect ball.
Silva, who was at the heart of probably the most striking example of the confusion VAR is bringing this weekend. He was brought down in the penalty box by Jefferson Lerma, the Bournemouth midfielder, and after a check from VAR, which showed clear contact and a stamp on his foot, essentially, no penalty was awarded. James, you were at the game. What did you make of this? And what do you make of the weekend's kind of VAR incidents, which were a little bit perplexing? And it's just kind of highlighting the contradictions in this law.
For me, this was a really bad use of VAR. This was the incident was Silva dribbled into the box, went down under a challenge from Jefferson Lerma, and Andre Mariner did not give a penalty, but it was subsequently reviewed. And from the replays, it was quite clear that Jefferson Lerma had in fact trod on David Silva's foot. Clear foul. But no penalty was given, and we're told that this is because of this, you know, theoretical high bar threshold for VAR intervention, i.e., you know, this kind of concept that you don't want to overturn the referee's decision unless it's a clear and obvious mistake. For me, this is the absolute worst of all worlds because you had a game being paused and held up while a clear refereeing mistake was reviewed but wasn't overturned on the grounds that it wasn't a large enough howler. I mean, for me, that is just, it's the absolute worst of all worlds. Terrible use of technology. I still feel, and I've mentioned this before, I still feel strongly that the by far the best way of implementing VAR is to have some sort of challenge system. I think that would solve a lot of problems.
Well, why would it be different? If there'd been a challenge on that decision, it wouldn't have made any difference to the outcome. Just because you're a manager who makes a challenge doesn't mean they're automatically going to overrule the referee.
Yeah, it's the high threshold that is the issue. Really,
you're right, actually. That wouldn't have made a particular difference in this case. I just feel that it would be better because at the moment we're sort of... I just feel the current state of kind of reviewing...
I'm kind of torn about it. I think any of the incidents this weekend... I mean, Harry Kane was, you know, fouled by Jamal Lascelles as he fell to the ground. I think all of them... They were, in real time, probably you were unsure about the decision. You didn't say that's a Stonewall penalty in real time. I don't think any of them for any of them. Whereas when you see the replay, you obviously have the benefit of the slowed down action, and David Silva's did look like a penalty kick. But I understand why they want to have a high threshold, because like we don't want the game stopped for every incident. And well, I mean, what do you think, Alison? It's not a straightforward situation, because in real time they didn't look like penalties. But is it a waste of time then having the technology if when we use it we're not actually given the correct decision?
Well, it's become a philosophical problem now, because it now depends what sort of referee you've got refereeing your match. Have you got a referee who thinks I feel comfortable awarding a penalty even though I'm aware that it might not be a penalty because I'm going to get the backup of VAR? Or are you a penalty that thinks the opposite? They think, oh, well, you know, they're going to back me come what may, so I won't give a penalty. I'm happier as a person, as a referee, as someone in charge of this game, I am happier not giving the penalty unless I'm absolutely convinced it's a, you know, Stonewall foul, knowing that I'm off the hook, because... That's what it does. It takes... We're not talking about the referees, and I think we should be. If they want a high bar in order to make sure matches are not refereed by monitor, and they're going to back what the referees do, then we have to go back to what we used to do, which was analyse the referees. And we need to know why they make the decisions they're making. I think they've had a bit of training on how to cope with the imposition of VAR, but how it affects them as doing their job... I don't think they even know yet. I think you'll find some personalities retreating into the "I'm not giving a penalty" personality, and some will go for the "Oh, I can be bold." The penalty given in the Wolves Burnley match, was to me in real time clearly not a penalty.
Absolutely, very soft.
But maybe that referee wouldn't have given it if he hadn't had VAR backup. But in fact, the VAR backup is irrelevant because they're going to back you anyway.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Alison, you tweeted something that I thought was spot on, in the kind of the supposedly objective decisions, i.e., you know, the likes of offside, which is supposed to be, you know, completely yes or no, clear cut. We don't really like being adjudicated to a totally objective standard. I think people in general sort of... The general consensus is that seems to be that people prefer to have a little bit of kind of leeway and refereeing interpretation on offside calls than to have them sort of refereed to this kind of absurd standard where you're sort of like checking, like, you know, inches of shoulder, millimetres of kneecap. Whereas the kind of just decisions that are supposedly subjective, like penalties, for me, are currently being reviewed in a way that is too kind of, that leaves too much room for the referees, you know, gives too much credit to the referee's interpretation. The Lerma one was a good example. It's absolutely clear foul. You know, he trod on David Silva's foot. But because fouls are deemed to be a subjective call, which, I mean, yes, they are to an extent. In that case, we had to stick with Andre Marin's decision, which I think 95% of people would agree was wrong.
And so, the people making the VAR decisions are mates with the referees on the pitch. They all know each other. It's only another bloke. It's one other bloke, basically. And it's his mate made a decision, and he's been told, high bar, don't re-referee the game. What's he going to do? You probably need, for VAR to work properly, and I'd rather it just didn't exist, let's just say that again. If for VAR to work properly, you probably need a panel of 826 highly trained officials.
Come on, Alison, we're getting in a wormhole here.
Who watch it and all press a button to say yes or no on the penalty. And if there's a certain percentage gap that's big enough that overrules, then you overrule.
Paul, what do you make of these this kind of high threshold? That sums it up. You don't have to go any further if you don't want.
Yeah, I find the whole... I don't like VAR, to be honest. I just think it's... To me, it wasn't necessary to bring in. I didn't understand why the Lascelles challenge on Kane yesterday wasn't a penalty at the end. He clearly impeded Kane in the penalty area. To me, when they check that, I'm thinking, well, they're going to have to give a penalty for this. I suppose that didn't come under the threshold as well. But I just find I'm hoping the whole focus on VAR will blow over and we'll go back to just talking about the actual football, because I just find it's just not for me. I just wish they'd not brought it in. Human error, and let's just go with what we've always had, and it wasn't that bad before. So,
okay. Well, I think the only decision that was overturned from VAR was Olivier Giroud on Tim Krul at Carrow Road. Big win for Frank Lampard and Chelsea, who got his first win, and Tammy Abraham scored his first two goals for Chelsea as well, which Lampard said will do wonders for his confidence. Alison, you were there. How did Tammy Abraham play, and do you think he can lead the line successfully for Chelsea this season?
Well, he took his goals well. He's not a terribly imposing striker yet. I felt if I had to buy one right now, I'd go for Pookie over Abraham because of his overall contribution to the match. There's that sort of... I was very impressed by Pookie. It's the first time I'd seen him in the flesh, and he looks completely different than he does on television. He's muscly and powerful and dominates and looks like someone who has complete total self-belief with no arrogance attached. Very impressed. Abraham could easily become a great striker, but you can tell he's still learning, and but he can strike the ball. He can score goals. He's obviously good. I just felt his overall involvement is an area he needs to work on, perhaps. And I think the point is really that Frank is happy for him to be learning on the job. We've now reached the end of the era of Chelsea where they have this huge amount of talent that are being told, learn somewhere else, learn in a different division, learn at a different club, learn abroad. But there's, under Frank Lampard, he wants them to be learning in the first team, which is obviously risky. But for as long as the fans are happy, and I was really struck, I've seen a lot of Chelsea over the years, and I was really struck by how I honestly felt they could have lost. They could have lost at Carrow Road, and the fans would still have sung how happy they were to have Frank Lampard in charge. He will have time, and I think the people in charge at Chelsea will give him the time for as long as the fans want him there. They didn't like the mood last season. Chelsea did rather well to finish third and win a piece of silverware, but the fans were vocally very, very angry, and they want that connection. They want a connection from the terraces to the pitch. They want to feel that the people who were scoring goals for them supported Chelsea as a kid, were trained by Chelsea as they were growing up, and have their heart and soul as part of it. And they're getting that now. And there'll be blips along the way, but for as long as the fans are happy, I think this is going to be a new phase in Chelsea history. I think the ownership will be happy too.
Yeah, James, the starting lineup had an average age of 24 years and 208 days, which was their youngest in the Premier League since February 1994. Mason Mount also impressed, got man of the match. There are some reasons to be cheerful for Chelsea now.
I mean, yes, absolutely. It's so funny, isn't it, to kind of, you know, see Chelsea, who have been, you know, really probably a Champions League level team for, you know, most of the past kind of five to ten seasons, really, with obviously quite a lot of fluctuation along the way, but you know what I mean. And now the kind of, particularly the front lineup that they're playing is so kind of totally different, because it's like, it's the sort of lineup that you'd sort of, with respect to Mount and Abraham, it's, you know, it's kind of a mid-table-ish sort of, or, you know, Europa League level attacking lineup. But I guess it's the attitude of the fans and people's expectations are so important, because I don't think people are disappointed by that. I think people are quite... My impression is that the fans are quite prepared for Chelsea to finish sixth this season, and you know, have a sort of broadly positive, but not, you know, if Tammy Abraham scores, you know, 10 or 12 goals, let's say, you know, that people would be absolutely okay with that. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
It will be interesting to see how they cope in the Champions League.
For sure.
I mean, they're there with the experiment. It could go one of two ways, really.
Yeah, and I think Mount is so interesting as well, because he's playing in that sort of, although he's playing wide.
Moved on to the left, I think.
But I think he's obviously gonna play quite a lot in that sort of number 10 role, which is really interesting, because he's not really yet, we haven't really seen him at all much in his career to suggest that he's a creator. I mean, he only got 4 assists at championship level last season. But he does really appear to have a sort of that kind of indefinable sort of goal scoring knack. And obviously he's got that real connection with Frank Lampard, who is the player that he idolised growing up, the player that he wrote a project on when he was sort of, you know, during his studies at Chelsea's academy, the manager who he played under at Derby last season, who said, "Wear the number 8." You know, there's obviously, and you know, there's that real kind of intangible connection between, you know, master and apprentice, if you want to put it like that. And it'll be so interesting to see. Mount had a good season at Derby last season, but I don't think kind of took the world by storm. But it'll be so interesting to see how much Frank Lampard can bring out of him.
Looking at Norwich, Paul, you'll have seen them at Anfield on the opening day. They've had quite a tough start, but they have impressed. What do you think a good season looks like for them this season? Just staying up, or could they possibly do even better?
I think obviously staying up would be a really good season for them. I like what they've done, not just feeling the need to spend when coming up. They've backed Pukki to get the goals in the Premier League. He got 29 in the Championship last season. You know, he's somebody who can score, and I just like the way Norwich have sort of been brave to sort of. You know, people accuse them of not having any ambition because they've not spent loads of money, but really the ambition that they showed was by sticking to the philosophy of Farker and the director of football, Stuart Webber, in backing these young players. And there are going to be ups and downs, and they have had, you know, Liverpool, Chelsea in your first few fixtures, and I think they've got Manchester City as well soon. But I think, especially at Anfield and again on at the weekend, they will cause problems for teams, and I think they'll score goals, and that gives them a great chance of staying up. I think they've got a lot of good young English players, Max Ahrens, Godfrey, Jamal Lewis, Cantwell as well. So I actually hope Norwich do well this season, because I think it would send a bit of a message out to the promoted clubs that you don't have to spend massive amount of money if you've got the sort of resources already at your disposal. You don't have to rip it up, basically. I think they took a lot of sort of credence from what Bournemouth did when they came up, and that Eddie Howe basically backed the squad that did so well in the Championship last season. And I think Norwich scored about 94 goals last season. They've shown that they will score goals again, and that's the hardest thing to do, and staying up will be a great achievement for them, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did a little bit better than that.
Elsewhere, Leicester City had an encouraging 2-1 victory against Sheffield United at Bramall Lane. 6 minutes after coming on, Harvey Barnes rifled in a peach of a half volley, definitely the goal of the weekend, to take all 3 points. Chris Wilder wasn't a very happy man. He said he was not going to pat his players on the back for working hard. Leicester, though, are up to fourth with 5 points from the opening 3 games, and are many people's team to break into the top 6. What do we think, Alison? Are Leicester best placed to reach the top 6?
Far too early to say. I think they're helped by the fact that Wolves are obviously distracted, and for as long as they're in the Europa League, will continue to be distracted. They've got nice players, Leicester, and they've, you know, I don't know why we keep going on about them being plucky outsiders. They did win the Premier League not so long ago, so maybe the challenge there really is to think bigger rather than think that they're on people's coattails trying to do plucky job. They need to reassess their ambition. Well, I mean, if you've won the Premier League, you should think of yourself as a top 4 club, shouldn't you?
There's absolutely no reason to think. I really don't think there's any reason for Leicester to feel that their squad is inferior to Chelsea's this season. I don't think there's much, if anything, between those squads in terms of kind of overall talent level. I mean, Leicester's midfield, you know, Ndidi, Tielemans, Maddison. I mean, that is top quality midfield. That midfield could play in the Champions League.
And Harvey Barnes coming off the bench, and what a strike that was. He's a real player. He was fantastic for West Brom on loan last season, and obviously was called back in January. But he has a habit of scoring goals like that as well, and you're not going to see a more finely struck shot than that.
Was it
really
the best Barnes goal of the weekend?
Go on.
I thought Ashley Barnes' goal was better.
No.
Yes. Further okay. away.
Well, that's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Alison Rudd, James Gearbrand and Paul Joyce. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information and we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.